Okay, so we actually finished the patriarch last week. That was a big accomplishment. Took forever to get through, but Abraham certainly had a rich life and a great deal that we learned from that life. And now as we come to this second part of chapter 25, we're going to begin to look at the life and the times of Isaac and Rebekah. So as you can see, I was able to find some of the official photo family albums so we can get a look of what they look like and so forth. I always find it interesting to see how we render Middle Easterners as white people. We tend to make them white all the time with beards, which is probably not what they really look like. But it is interesting just to see it from the range of caricatures to honest attempts at representing what they might have looked like. But we're going to look at the life and times of Isaac and Rebekah. Hopefully we'll get through that entirely. Just by way of giving you a sense of game plan here, I will be with you this week and next week. Although next week we will have one of our missionaries visiting and sharing with us during this time. I don't know that they'll take the entire time, but it's Todd and Julie Hendry. They are church planters in Croata, Brazil, which is kind of in the northeast portion of the country. So they're going to share with us during the time here, and then I'll take the rest of the time to finish what we didn't do today. And then beginning in November, Nick Forrester, who you've probably all met at this point in time, is going to do a short series. I'll let him introduce that perhaps next week, and I'll be only in the South Campus for a while. So anybody wants to continue to follow the series, it'll be recorded down there. Otherwise, it's been a joy to be with you all, and it's been fun to go through this stuff. So the life and times of Isaac and Rebekah. You know, kind of some opening thoughts as I looked at these real chapter and a half, really, is really the first thing is how strikingly short the account for Isaac is. You know, Abraham, Jacob, and Joseph each get about 12 chapters, and Isaac gets kind of one full chapter to himself and then a few verses in chapter 25. And his death then is recorded in 35, 28, and 29. So it's kind of I'd say cursory at best, but it's a very overviewish. And it would seem basically that we've learned as much about Isaac as the author wants us to know from what we saw in the Abraham account. Really, he was the focal point of the seed. And then also we see his amazing faith in submitting to his father sacrificing him. So we've learned a lot about Isaac. We learn a great deal about his character and so forth. And then with the account of Genesis 26, it functions kind of like a slideshow. So if you think of a wedding or maybe some kind of family reunion or that other thing we go to sometimes called funerals, you tend to see these collages or kind of snapshots or slideshows of people's life. And as I looked at this section, I kind of looked at this and said, boy, this is kind of like a snapshot. Because in fact, he lived the longest of the patriarchs. Yet he is not an insignificant individual. He is one of the four patriarchs. He does receive and pass on the covenant blessings. And again, he's important to the story. Although his life, perhaps like his general personality, is somewhat bland, and it seems that his legacy is to be a bridge from his famous father to the greater narrative of his son, Jacob. So he kind of seems to kind of fulfill a bridge type role. Now, from a standpoint of structure, kind of three sections to these chapter and a half. The first is, in 25, 19 to 26, we see this Ela Toledoth again, announcing the new generation. So we're going to learn about the generations of Isaac. In 27 to 34, we're going to get a little insight into marriage and family dynamics. So they squabbled in their families, just like we squabble in our families today. And then finally, we get this life and times of Isaac in chapter 26, 1 to 35. And what we're going to see when we get there are what I'm going to call six little vignettes or stories that the author chooses to highlight about Isaac's life. And then it's going to end with this little final disappointment in the last two verses of chapter 26. So that's the general structure that we have for this section. Now, with that in mind, if you happen to read ahead and study, as I know you all do every week, right? You guys go ahead and you study and I wonder what he's going to say. Oh, yeah, I'll figure that one out. Okay. Well, what is the main point of the chapter? What do you think the main point of this kind of reflection on Isaac and his life is really demonstrating for us?
It seems the passage of the lineage.
Yeah, certainly passage of the lineage. We see that. I mean, that's kind of the generational line that we see there. But there's kind of a subtext I hear, think that's kind of important. It's hard to be hard to pick it out if you hadn't spent time on it. But it's, again, this idea of God's unfailing faithfulness. Okay, so the subtext here, or the kind of core message in these sections, is God's continuing faithfulness to the patriarchs, both in terms of his covenant promises and his covenant blessings. Now, there's one key thing about the structure that clues us into the main point. And again, if you hadn't looked at it, if you read 26, right, if you happen to read 26 ahead of time, the question that should come to your mind is simply, there's no new data here. Okay, so this is kind of the clue. Okay, chapter 26 is basically just a complete parallel with the Abraham narrative. I mean, Isaac's recorded life events are a perfect parallel for what we just saw with Abraham. So there's essentially no new data in the narrative. Rather, it seems to be almost a recapitulation of the events in Abraham's life, in Isaac's life, and God's faithfulness. So as you look at it, that's the thing I struggled with as I looked at the section. I said, gee, what's this really all about? And trying to figure out the underlying scenario. So kind of just looking at it at a highlight level, both of them sought wives, right, from their family tree. Of course, Abraham brought Sarah with him, and Isaac, the servant, was sent back to get Rebekah from Haran. Both wives were barren, right? Sarah for about 39 years and Rebekah for about 19 years. Both patriarchs experienced bitter family dynamics arising from sibling rivalries. So we see this sibling rivalry occur again and again. Both of them, after the opening act, deal with famine, and we see how they try to resolve that with human means. Abraham and Isaac both resort to deceit, right? She is my sister. Both patriarchs grew rich at the expense of the Philistines. Both experienced persecution from the Philistines, strife over the wells or the water, and then obviously leading to peace treaties. And perhaps most important, both men receive and are assured of God's promises and his blessings. So Isaac's life is just a complete parallel to what we saw, both in content and even the order of the content that we go through there. So this is what got me thinking, what's the point of this chapter if there's really no new data? And I think it is just to continue to show God's unfailing faithfulness. So Isaac prayed. There are some differences. Isaac prayed and waited on the Lord, right? So we see Abraham is a much more proactive individual. Isaac seems almost kind of passive, but we'll look at that a bit this week. Isaac's faith doesn't seem to be tested quite as intensely as Abraham's was, perhaps just already a result of what we've seen of that in the prior account. Isaac seems more passive in every way, and we certainly see a degree of self-centeredness in his behavior. And the Isaac narrative, as I said, is kind of like a rerun of his life, right? So kind of affirming these ideas, that God's faithfulness in the past can be counted on in the present and the future, and what God has done for the fathers, he will also do for the sons. So I think this is the core point of this Isaac narrative, okay? So what he's done for the fathers, he will continue to do for the sons and continue through the patriarchal line. So again, this idea of God's unfailing faithfulness. And I think the reason that we see kind of just a recapitulation or a complete parallel is because we see same circumstances, same people, but what? Same God, okay? God responds to the things in the exact same manner and the exact same process, which I think if we bring that into kind of a New Testament perspective for us, is an assurance that Christ is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. So God is unchanging, and I think that's a pretty strong assurance of our faith. He's not fickle, he doesn't change over time, and we can count on the promises. If we can, what's that make our faith? You use a technical term like silly or useless or, you know, kind of why bother, right? But yet, fickle. Yeah, right. So, you know, the point is that he is reliable, and we kind of see this pattern being laid down in the first parts of the book. So, someone get us started by reading 19 to 26 in chapter 25, please. 19 to 26.
These are the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham fathered Isaac. And Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean in Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah his wife conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, the older shall serve the younger." When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them.
Okay, so we start off here with this, again, tenfold repetition of this phrase that we heard that, as we looked at the initial structure, is the marker that the writer uses to continue narrowing the focus. So this word, Ela Toledoth, or this is the account of, or these are the generations of, however your Bible translates that phrase. And each time that this occurs, the focus narrows to the generations that follow. So we start here with kind of very cursory genealogy, just establishing and placing both Isaac and Rebekah, right? So Isaac is the son of Abraham, Rebekah is the daughter from the family, so it's just kind of a little summary review. And then the narrative, we learn that he's 40 years old when he married Rebekah, who, like Sarah, was barren. Yet, unlike Sarah, she didn't resort to plan B, right? What was Sarah's solution to her barrenness? Yeah, throw women at him. Okay, well, that didn't work out too well, did it? Now, I do think we have to give Isaac a little credit here. If you recall, when we ended up the last chapter, it said he genuinely loved his wife. So I think we see kind of a better picture of marital love out of Isaac than we saw out of the other scenarios. But the fact of the matter is that she was barren, just like Sarah, not quite as long a time. Now, they pursued God for the solution. So what was the solution? How did they resolve the problem? Okay, they prayed, right? So Isaac prayed. And so we should note that some of what we may see as his passivity is his piety. And unlike Abraham, God doesn't make them wait quite as long. He answers in only 20 years. And again, don't be confused, okay? If you read just verse 21, you'd think, oh, bam, he prayed. Next thing you know, she's pregnant. But you got to jump down to verse 26, where you see that it's recorded that he was 60 years old when she finally had children. So I don't think it took him 20 years to recognize that she was barren. I think he probably figured that out pretty early and started praying at that time. And in a matter of about 19 years, obviously, counting the year of pregnancy, God answered that prayer, and he made her able to have children. So in their patience, we see both Isaac and Rebekah's piety and their faith, kind of in contrast to Abraham and Sarah's man-made plans. And I really think that these two aspects of Isaac's character are the most distinguishing or notable aspects of who he is. Now, we'll get to this a little later, and we'll put a New Testament label on that, because I think he represents this particular characteristic in a significant way. But right now, we see it both as his piety and his faith. Now, God did answer the prayer. We see in verses 22 and 23 that she was pregnant, but apparently it was a rather unusual pregnancy, right? And all of you moms know that the kids will kind of rustle around in there a little bit. Apparently these kids were wrestling around just a bit more than she might have expected. So she didn't really understand what it meant. So again, we see her piety in that she goes to inquire of the Lord, who promptly answers with a couple of prophetic insights. So, what do we learn from God's response? What are the prophetic insights that we get?
He's going to have people who have lots of people.
Yeah, okay. So we kind of see the whole thing. There's going to be how many nations in her womb?
Two.
So we kind of continue to see this process of many nations, kind of a particular nation and then the other nations. Okay, so affirmation of the many nations and the distinction among the nations. Okay. Now, what do we see about God's methods from this prophetic statement? What do we see about his methods? Kind of see some theology in here, right? Right? We see choice, well, right? So we see choice, clearly, right? So we see his methods. So we see a couple of things, right? So he often works with the weaker vessel, right? So the younger is going to rule over the older. That's certainly not characteristic of how things would have normally worked in the process. And clearly, the more broken we are, the more able God is to work with us, because he's got less junk to get out of the way first. So we see that. He unconditionally elects whom and what he will use. Now, this section and this choosing of Jacob over Esau is cited frequently, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And in Romans 9, Paul makes a big, big deal out of this as he explains God's pause for the Gentiles, setting aside the Jews for a period of time, and then accomplishing his purposes before he'll come back and fulfill his promises entirely to the Jewish nation. And finally, we see in Jacob's selection, God overruled the natural custom with supernatural revelation. So kind of the thing here that I like to think about is, you know, we all want to know what God's will is, right? And what do we really know? What do we really want to know when we say that? What? Well, yeah, our will, or what's going to happen to us. But basically, we don't want to know his revealed will, because we haven't, right? What do we want to know? The unrevealed stuff, the next step, what's coming, right? And so basically, every time you try to do that, I can tell you that I have the best intentions. This has got to be what God wants. He wants me to go back to Northeast China. He wants me to train those pastors. He wants me to be ready, because North Korea, I'm certain, is going to open up at some point in time. Here I am speaking English in America. Okay? So look, I mean, every time I try to handicap whatever God's got in mind, let's just say I wouldn't make a very good bookie, or I would probably qualify for what profession in America?
Weatherman.
Absolutely right. Right? The only guy that can be wrong all the time and still get paid more. A great job. But seriously, you know, God just works in his own very particular ways. You know, trying to figure out how and what God's going to do is really fool's gold, right? Today's troubles have enough. Focus on that. We'll deal with tomorrow when we get to tomorrow. So what is really kind of remarkable, though, in light of everything I just said about verse 23? What does God do that is different from what I just said about what he normally does?
He told him exactly what's going to happen.
Yeah, he gives her the plan right up front, right? This is what we all really want when we got God's will, right? God, should I take that job? You know, you don't really want to take the job. You just want to know if it's going to work out and you're going to make a lot of money and it's not going to be hard work. Should I marry that man or that woman? Is it going to work out? Is she the right one? Is he the right one? I mean, we all want to know what the outcome is going to be versus just moving along in faith. So he is kind of different. He gives Rebecca the plan up front. So there's no guessing and no wondering about how things are going to work out or proceed in the next generations. Now, when her time was complete, in verses 24 to 26, behold, just as God said, twins were born, right? And they most obviously were fraternal twins, right? Not identical twins. So I did go back to the family album here, found some pictures just in case you need a visual, right? So first we have a caricature of them, right? He's kind of like, you know, Hulk or something. And there's meek little Jacob there cooking a thing. And then kind of more a realistic type of attempt, right, at kind of what it might look like. Now, I like pictures, okay? I think visuals are fun, but it just is humorous to see kind of how people try to characterize these things in these different pictures. So, obviously fraternal twins, not identical twins. Esau actually means hairy, okay? And another name that will be given to him is going to be Edom, which means red. So red and hairy, I don't know what Rebecca thought when he came out, like, woo, I hope the other one looks better. You know, and then Isaac, Jacob's name means heel grabber or supplanter. So that must have been a wild, you know, breech birth, right? The hands up there grabbing on the heel and, you know, all kinds of things you can imagine going on in that process. But the fact of the matter is the two children come out and bottom line is they couldn't be more different. So someone read 27 to 34, please.
Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his gain, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking the stew, Esau came in from the field and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of the red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore, his name was called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I'm about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright.
Okay, so interesting scenario. So twins of two natures, and they really couldn't be much different, right? So Esau is the nomadic outdoorsman. He's the man's man, right? He's the guy that's on the old Winston cigarette commercial ads, the tough guy out there. I don't smoke. That's not an endorsement for cigarettes, by the way. It is kind of funny that you have such a healthy-looking life, and I suspect if you saw that guy, he probably doesn't look so good today. But Jacob was more refined, preferring to live and work from a settled location. So temperamentally, they're quite different, along with appearance. They are functional, temperamental, and physical opposites whose only commonality are to mom and dad. So now we get a little insight into mom and dad. And what do we learn about the two of them? They have favorites. Now, I know none of you parents have favorites, do you? No, you love them all, you cut the finger, it's the blood, it's the same, it's all the same, and so forth. But you know what? The truth of the matter is, sometimes some kids are a little more tough to deal with than others, right? So the fact is that they show partiality. Isaac loved Esau for some deep, deep reasons. He brings home good chow, right? And maybe on top of that, he's kind of everything that Isaac wishes he was, right? Bah, I wish I was a manly man like that. And Rachel loved Jacob. We don't really get any reasons why, but I suspect that she was probably temperamentally more similar to her personality. Although I think she probably also knows what God told her, which I don't think she sat on the information, and so she probably has some affinity because of that. So we certainly see abjectly poor parenting, right? Partiality is going to lead to nothing but trouble. And this is really only a microcosm of the poor parenting we see, right? Because basically, they let Esau run wild, don't they? They don't really rein him in much in the process. And Isaac is demonstrating poor leadership versus that of his father. So I think we had a pretty good picture of Abraham's leadership. We saw it in the servant. We see it in his household. Isaac seems to be a bit more of a laissez-faire parent in the process. Now we get in verses 29 to 34 what I call the great exchange. So basically, Esau gives up everything for nothing, right? He gives up everything for nothing, a little pot of stew or a little bowl of stew. So what's kind of one lesson you can be mindful of at the outset? What's something that kind of jumps to mind to you as you read how Esau dealt with this situation? Kind of a warning, if you would.
Make sure you know what's up.
Yeah, I think it's the idea of be sure we know what's important, and I would kind of tweak that a bit to say this, and that is the destructive power of our desires, okay? Now, the point is, it always comes down to something we desire more than God. Now, desires in and of themselves are somewhat neutral. The problem is when you're confronted with the desire at the moment of impact, what are you going to do, right? So desires linger there in your heart. They have destructive power, and a small thing, a moment of weakness, can have a pretty significant impact, all right? So think about it in the ministry for a second, right? So you hear about these kind of failures of pastors, kind of these visible failures and kind of immorality and things of that nature. You know, none of them, I think, ever set out to ruin their lives, right? But there's some desire that's harboring in their heart. Maybe they don't feel like they're being appreciated enough by their congregations or their wife. And again, none of these are good desires. But the fact of the matter is, Satan is prowling, right? He knows what's going on in your heart. He's waiting for the opportune time to do it. So kind of as you look at this, we see how a momentary desire can really have a long-term impact on what happens in your life. So Esau comes in from the hunt. He's tired and hungry. And he politely, he does. He says, "Please, you know, give me some of that red stuff to eat," literally. And he doesn't say to eat. He says, "Give me that. I need to gobble it down." is what it really says in the Hebrew. So he just wants to just wolf down some chow is what it comes down to, right? He's coming from the field. He's having a great time running around with the boys, shooting things, bringing stuff home, and I'm hungry. And that's what his desire is, the only thing that's in his heart at the moment. Now, Jacob seizes the moment and makes a demand in verse 31, right? So, does that seem like a reasonable request? No, it doesn't, does it? I mean, my goodness, certainly seems excessive to me. So, what does it suggest to you about Jacob?
He lives up to his
name. Yeah, he certainly does, right? Knowing Esau's character, he's probably been planning for a moment like this. Now, I got to say, the commentators are all over the board on this stuff. You know, they paint the picture of that Esau is just a physical and temporal man, and Jacob is a spiritually strong man, and all these different kind of things. And, you know, I think in general those are probably true. But, boy, they paint Jacob a lot nicer than I think he is, and they hammer Esau maybe a bit more than he deserves. The fact is, Jacob shows some unsavory character in the process as well. Your brother comes in, he's your brother. He just wants a bowl of stew, right? Well, you know what? If you give me everything you have, I'll let you have a bite. Really? What a brother. Okay, so obviously he's scheming. He's been prepared for this, right? So in 32, I think this is a classic flanking move, okay? I like what he says. He's just basically trying to get Jacob off this bone, right? He says, oh, come on, I'm about to die. Throw me a bone here, okay? I think he's just trying to distract him, which I think then gives us even stronger evidence for Jacob's character because Jacob doesn't let it go, does he? He presses the issue. No, first swear. Now, he obviously knows Esau's character. He obviously knows, I suspect, what his mother had heard. There's nothing to suggest that she didn't share this first with Isaac, and probably with both the boys, if you will, okay? So what's he trying to do? He's trying to bring it about by human means, okay? So further confirming his premeditated intention. So through the idea of an oath is kind of foreign to us in the West, we shouldn't take it lightly. Okay, because it was legally binding. And as we'll see as you get further into the story, when Isaac gives the blessing, there's no amount of crying, sobbing, sense of remorse, or anything, even genuine repentance, that can change his selling of the birthright. So then we see Esau's true character, though, however, in 33b and 34, right? What does he do? He relents, okay? He does. He says, okay, sells the birthright. So he ate and he drank and he went on his way. So he was completely unconcerned, and that's why we see this statement at the end of the section. He despised his birthright. Yeah, Sue.
Doesn't it show, in a way, also the contrast between like living for the present and planning for the future, but there needs to be like a happy medium in there, because Esau's only thinking about present, you know, like pleasures, and Jacob is so future-minded, you know, that he doesn't care what he's doing to his brother.
Those are some good observations, and we'll make those in just a second. So those are concluding remarks. No, it's good. Yeah, I like
good
what you're
contrast.
Thinking. Yeah, good contrast, right? Very clear contrast, right? Kind of A or B. So what do you think Esau was thinking? Dan, did you have something?
First of all, I think he was a drama queen.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I think that's part of it, but obviously he didn't care about the spiritual blessing that it was to be. I was going to highlight what you talked about before about the parenting. I don't think either guy had good character. And I think that's borne out through the entire Jacob's life until finally dad gets hold of him and says,
yeah,
here we
yeah.
go.
Finally's got to knock his hip out of whack. Yeah.
He was probably in his hundred before he finally figured it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Esau was very, very self-minded and didn't care about the impact that that's what I was talking about, my priorities earlier.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. You know, and as we see later on, you know, Jacob gets caught in his own scheming, right?
Oops.
And then he gets home and God finally breaks him by kicking his hip out of socket, right? Okay, so he finally gets his attention and he does those things. But yeah, so what do you think he was thinking? Well, first of all, I'd say he wasn't thinking, he was just feeling, right? But if he was thinking, he obviously placed no value on the promise, okay? So kind of rejecting the gospel. So Sue, a little bit to your point here, He's not thinking of anything of an eternal nature. He's not thinking of the value of these promises. And, you know, in fairness to all the patriarchs, as you read, you know, Hebrews 11, and it talks about this cluster of patriarchs, what does it say? That even though they never saw, right, the whole point is they knew there was a better future, they hung for that better future, they relied and had faith on the better future. And it really is the essence of our Christian life, isn't it? I mean, you're going to hear a message this morning that's going to challenge you in terms of your discipleship and the demands of discipleship. But the fact of the matter is, you know, it's a lot easier not to be a Christian. You know, and if you're not going to be a Christian, then my take would be you ought to be the best hedonist possible. Because that's all you got. Okay, whatever amount of time you got. So you better go get all the gusto you can. And I often, people will say to me, well, don't you ever worry about this not being true? And I said, I don't worry about it. I do think about it from time to time. I mean, at times I read some of the heresies and I say, boy, that's crazy. And I think of the story and I say, well, that's a little crazy too. But the fact is there's truth and we have evidence for the process. But the thing I can say, I think with some level of certainty is, I don't know that I would change anything about my life. I mean, there's a sense where as we're following Christ, I think he takes these other desires away from us. I told the story about Katie a bunch of times. She kept saying, do you miss your old life? Until I got sick of it. Finally told her, if you ask me again, we're done. And sensitive guy that I am. But she did make me think. I said, yeah, I miss my den. So I had a nice man cave in my house, and that was the room where nobody but the dog could come in and me. You know, and I missed my grill. I was like, yeah, I really don't miss that. And she goes, oh, well, you're called. I was like, oh, okay. We're stopping. Keep walking. But the whole fact of the matter is God does take these things away from you. It's not like you're kicking and screaming and giving them away. He just sets your heart on different things in the process. So, you know, maybe it's wrong, but I wouldn't live any differently. So I think there's kind of a sense of comfort, at least for me, in that process. And then finally, it could very well be that Esau just, hey, he knew the writing on the wall, so he didn't care. Now, you know, this was God's plan. It's kind of hard to change God's plan, so I have a little bit of sympathy for Esau in the process. But what's the deeper subtext of the exchange? What's kind of the deeper subtext of the whole exchange here?
Fulfillment of God's promise to Rebekah.
Yeah, I think Jacob's lack of faith, okay, fulfilling the promises to Rebekah, but Jacob's lack of faith, right? So he had the right goal. He just had the wrong method. Right, so he's trying to bring about God's revealed will through human methods and human means, whereas God's already said, look, I'm going to take care of this. So he could have done that. So he valued the better thing, but he certainly wasn't the better man. Okay, he was simply God's choice in the process. So what is involved with the birthright? Well, a couple of things. First of all, there's the kind of the material aspect of the birthright, which means the one who holds the birthright gets a double material blessing. But secondly, they also have succession rights to head the family. So the birthright was a pretty significant thing. So it wasn't a trivial matter, and Esau gave up everything for a bowl of stew, right? Which seems a little bit incredulous. So I do kind of think of the idea, though, even though it's God's plan, he is still working through human means, right? So there's a parallel in that for evangelism, right? Who's decided who's going to be saved? God. So why bother to evangelize? Right?
Because he told us to.
Right. So it's a pretty good book by Packer. He doesn't have all good stuff, but sovereignty, evangelism, the sovereignty of God. Why do you witness? Well, because God told us to. Number one, that's the simplest reason. But secondly, how does God bring people to faith in the end?
The hearing of the word,
right? So is he going to speak through other things? You're hearing the word? I mean, he does his things. He prepares them. Yeah?
Isn't that kind of what Paul had to do that in Acts when he said, I have many people in this city?
Yeah.
I mean, the whole goal was, I don't even know who
right.
he said, but yeah. people hear that God wants to say.
Yeah, I mean, it'd just be easy if God would put a mark on our forehead or something and say, I'm going to witness to that guy because it's very clear that he's going to be the elect, so I'm going to be the one that brings him in. Yeah. Right? But no, yeah, God doesn't do that. Right. Yeah, Nicholas.
Going back to the birthright, so the oldest child didn't get to inherit everything after father died?
No.
He just got
a double material portion, but he also got responsibility to head the family. So he makes all the additional decisions going forward. So it'll end up know, it's a positive thing. But yeah, he gets a double physical. So the point is the other kids don't get left out, or the other boys don't get left out. But he gets a double material blessing and then the head of the family. Yeah. Okay? So even though it's God's plan, he still works through our character. And so, you know, kind of what are some of the contrasts do we see here in the two character, you know, as we kind of sum up the narrative of these two guys? What's some of the notable contrasts you see in their character?
Jacob is pretty conniving. He's obviously thoughtful. He thinks things through. Esau's pretty open and blunt.
Right.
He's just kind of there.
Yeah,
he's
okay.
There's not death to him.
Yeah, right. He's just like the stat of a verb. He is.
Yeah.
And he does. Right, okay. And clearly Jacob's pretty conniving. What else?
Esau's kind of living in the moment. I'm going out to hunt. I'm doing this. Where Jacob's planning, forward thinking, looking for the future.
Ah, free-range chicken homebody, a man of the moment. I knew it was in there. Premeditated opportunist, all right? So, you know, Esau is kind of a free-range chicken, right? He's out there running around, doing whatever he wants, kind of just no boundaries, no controls. Jacob is a homebody, but then, as Michael said, Esau is a man of the moment, right? Whereas there's kind of a premeditated opportunist in Jacob that's looking for various different opportunities. Now, on the one hand, kind of you mentioned, I mean, you know, the idea of planning, I don't think is a bad idea, but the way I kind of tend to think of it is make your own plans, right? The way of the man, but God will direct his steps. So hold it loosely, right? Don't be holding on to it, right? Because if you're holding on to it hard, what's God got to do? He's got to pry your fingers off it first, knock it away, and then he can start working with it. So yeah, have a plan, but, you know, don't make that your idol or your desire in the process. So a man of the moment, premeditated opportunist, pleasure seeker, promise seeker, okay? Dramatic, you said drama queen. I mean, dramatic and urgent, right? I mean, I'm gonna die. Really? Okay, I don't think so. Whereas Jacob, on the other hand, is kind of ruthless and certainly not very compassionate, right? I mean, my goodness. Dismissive and careless, schemer and devious, right? And then spiritually dull is the way I would say it. He despised the birthright, and then more spiritually alert on Jacob's side, he certainly coveted the birthright, and we see that both in their characters. Yeah.
I think the question is, for those that think Jacob was somehow spiritually superior at this point,
right?
Was he really coveting the birthright for the spiritual blessing?
Yeah, he just thought that was a better deal. Yeah. Right. So we don't know how deep it was, and you know, I think we'd be careful not to swing to either or other extreme. I mean, again, remember, this is God's providential plan, mm-hmm. right? So in the end, this is what God intends to bring about. Now, whatever the motives of the characters are is kind of somewhat secondary. But it is interesting to see how God works things out through human frailty, right? So the fact of the matter is, he is working through us. He's working through that. It's one of the amazing things about God. I mean, he doesn't need us, but yet he does indeed work out his plan through us, which I think is kind of a neat deal. So, implications or food for thought. Can you identify parallels in your own life? Or maybe more like this, how are you compromising your inheritance by pursuing trivial temporal pleasures? And if you think I'm being harsh, then welcome to today's message. You're going to get it a little harder today. And I think he's exactly right on, right? You're not going to lose your salvation, but you are going to lose greater reward, right? I mean, we're clearly told in Scripture, what? You know, you're going to have reward. So I want to be the head pro at Augusta National. So I'm going to try to do my best here so I can get that job in the millennium. All right, but we'll see. But the fact of the matter is, in 1 Corinthians 3, it talks about it, doesn't it? We're clearly going to have rewards. Now, I'm a kind of simple guy. You ring the bell, I want some of that. Okay, but it is really, you think about it, in our lives, there are rewards. You're not going to lose out salvation, which is kind of the key part of the end of that section in chapter 3, right? You'll be judged, the bad deeds will be judged by fire, but not yet through, okay? Not to your salvation. But the fact of the matter is that, you know, what are you doing to compromise your inheritance? And it's real. You got to think about, what are you chasing after in this life, all right, that's going to keep you from the stuff? As you're going to hear, and I have to say past tense when I get down south because I've heard it, Mark has this kind of juxtaposed phrase in his message. You can be listening for it. I loved it when I read it, which is the idea of salvation is a free gift. It is, right? No question. But it will cost you everything. I mean, it will cost you everything, right? You know, Christianity is radical. It's radically different. You know, you are separate, distinct, different than the world, right? The world is going to look at you askew. They're going to think you're completely nuts, right? So it is. It's completely free gift, but it will cost you everything, right? It will cost you everything if you genuinely want to follow Christ. Okay, now look, I'm not talking about going out and living in a tent and giving all your stuff away and putting on a camel hair coat, right, and eating locusts. But the fact of the matter is, you know, your life should begin to change as you're following Christ. That doesn't mean you don't need to support your families and care for things and be prudent about taking care of your future, but it does say that your priorities are different, right? So it'll cost you everything. So are you considering the demand of discipleship, or do we look more like Esau? You know, what does our life look like? We don't want to look like Jacob, okay? But let's just use the Esau guy. Are we worrying about our next bowl of stew, or are we really looking at the more serious things? Okay, now, life and times of Isaac, and we're not going to get through all this today, but we'll get started on it. Now we come back to the chapter 26. So we've had this introductory section in 25, 19 to 34. And this is the only chapter that's completely devoted to Isaac, right? And his recorded life is really nothing more than a recapitulation of kind of the high points of Abraham's life, or some of the key events, right? So reminding us that the nature of man doesn't change, nor does the nature of God, okay? So this is kind of what I think the point is. He seems a man that's inexorably wedged between Abraham and Jacob. Right? And as one commentator said, well, I think, Isaac is the ordinary son of a great father and the ordinary father of a great son. Okay, so ordinary probably is a good word to describe Isaac, but he comes from a great father, so it's kind of tough, right? You got a really successful father and things of that nature. You're following in those footsteps can be challenging and overshadowing. And then, quickly, we're going to see that Jacob is a pretty major character and a significant guy. So he kind of is stuck there in the middle. Yes, he's no less a patriarch. He's just less prominent. So just like I said before, in the millennium, you know, some of us are going to be bossing others around. Okay? And that's going to be based upon what we accomplish in this life and what God looks as motives and positive things. And I don't mean that in a silly sense that it sounds, but there are going to be roles as we get into the millennial kingdom. And right? He who he entrusted with much, he'll entrust with more, and things of that nature. Okay? So, Genesis 25, 19 to 34 is actually interesting in that it is chronologically prospective, and Genesis 26 is chronologically retrospective. So, it's a fancy way of saying that 25, the events of 25, actually chronologically occur before the events of 26, right? So 25 is happening before the events of 26. So how do we know this? Now, I'm saying that, and everybody can say, okay, I see it makes sense. Can I prove it? Is there anything in the text that would help me prove that? It's always good to have textual evidence.
Sounds like verse 4 says, I will multiply your offspring as the stars of the heavens. You probably didn't have any children at that point.
Okay, I think you're on the right track, the one where you just keep going a little bit further into verses 6 to 9, right? So when he's discovered in his little sparking, or sporting is what the Hebrew word says, with his wife, basically, if they had kids, I don't know that they really could have pulled off the deception that she's just my sister, right? You know, I don't see where we have that situation in the ancient Near East. So we can prove it textually. So the events do come. So why does he go in this order? I mean, why does he go out of order chronologically? Because everything pretty much up till now has been chronological. Why does he do that?
That's what God wanted.
Yeah, that's always the right thing. God superintended it, and therefore he intended it to go first. All right, so, you know, just, yeah, and basically, to introduce Jacob and the reason for that follow in 27, okay, you know, so sometimes.
It kind of makes sense, because you go from, like, in verses 25, 12, where it's, you know, talking about the family, and it continues on, following the lineage.
Yeah. Yeah, you see that. You know, we saw that again if you go back to, if you remember all the way back to Genesis 2. And when we were in the first part of the things, we're arguing for why it's not a second creation. Okay, it's a prospective look. Then he goes back and gives us more detail about how he created the man. So he's setting the stage of what's important, which is ultimately that, hey, Isaac is going to pass the baton to Jacob, and I'm going to pass through him all the covenant promises and blessings. So yeah, you do see it, okay? Poor Isaac seems primarily to be a footnote, you know, acting as a bridge between Abraham and Jacob. But we can't feel too bad for him, right? He did live the longest, he did receive the covenant promises, and he did pass them along.
Wouldn't it also seem like he had the easier life?
Yeah, I guess you could say that.
From a standpoint, it didn't seem like he had to move as much, didn't have as much chaos with people around him.
Yeah.
It don't seem like there's much persecution.
Yeah, things were set up pretty well for the boy. Yeah, he does. He had a much easier life. He certainly did by comparison when you look at it. So as we move into the chapter, there are really kind of six little vignettes that the author chooses to focus on. The first one is in verses 1 to 5, which I call the covenant reaffirmation, and that's part one. We're going to see this twice, one of two times God speaks to him. 6 to 11, we kind of see like father, like son, same type of events. 12 to 14, we see God blessing Isaac, okay, same pattern, even though he fails, God comes in and blesses him. 15 to 22, trouble with the locals, okay. Covenant reaffirmation part 2 in verses 23 to 25, and then finally ends up with peace in the land in 26 to 33. So if you look at this, it is basically a summary microcosm of the whole Abraham narrative, and it goes in precisely the similar kind of order. And then finally he ends up in verses 34 and 35, and he looks at these fateful marriage of Esau, kind of Esau's last little jab at his parents before we move on to the birthright story in chapter 27. So we'll get started on these here this week, and then we'll finish up some. Somebody read verses 1 to 5 for me, please, in 26.
Now there was a famine in the land, besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Isaac went to Gerar, to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. And I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and will give your descendants all these lands, and by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws."
Okay, so we come in here, the focus in here is covenant reaffirmation. So verse 1 kind of sets the table for what follows in verses 2 to 4. Okay, so once again, there's a famine in the land. Key verse that it says in there is besides the previous famine. So again, this is where people that want to point to holes in the Bible, say, see, it's the same story, it's the same stuff, it's the same event. No, God kind of lays down some keywords just to make sure. Okay, besides the previous famine. Now, the previous famine was almost 80 years ago, okay, chronologically. So, summary statement of the situation, there's famine in the land, Isaac is sojourning for food, it's not the same Abimelech, okay, so about 80 years have passed and intervened since the Abraham famine. Abimelech was just simply a title, a generic title for Philistine kings, okay? Now, in verses 2 to 4, God appears to Isaac the first of two times that he does. And the first thing he tells him is, he commands him to stay in the land. In other words, don't go to Egypt. Now, whether he was on his way and planning to go there, and God said, don't do that, whether he was already settled and God was just reaffirming it, can't tell from the text, but the point is he doesn't want him to get out of the land because that is what happened with Abraham in the process. And then in verse 3a, he reaffirms the covenant blessings, and then 3b and 4, he reconfirms the covenant promises. Now remember, I kept highlighting this difference, right? So the promises are the unilateral promises that God gives through the Abrahamic covenant, right? The blessings is the degree to which God blesses him conditioned upon his obedience, okay? So there are two different things in the process. So the oath here is a reference to 22:16. So you remember back after he sacrificed or was prepared to sacrifice Isaac on Mount Moriah, right? God swears an oath to him and blesses him exceedingly because of his faithfulness, knowing that he was going to be obedient. Again, this third instance of the word zerah, seed, in 3 and 4, again, I think is likely singular. You've got descendants, 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 probably in most Bibles. I think it's descendants, descendants, descendant. Again, back to this thing we've talked about several times about there's going to be a specific large number of descendants, and then there's going to be a particular descendant, which is the seed line or the Messiah. But we see that again, kind of keeps recurring. And we remember from Abraham that the covenant promises are unilaterally going to endure, like I just said a minute ago, while the fullest enjoyment of covenant blessings is conditioned upon obedience, right? So you see this all over the Bible. We see this in 1 John as an example when you start that letter, and it talks about the quality of our fellowship with God, right? When's our quality with God, when's the quality of fellowship going to be impaired? Sin, right, okay. Not a hard concept, right? Quality of fellowship with your children is impaired when they're misbehaving, right? When they're behaving, quality's a lot better, right? Same scenario, same concepts, we see it again here. So, remember from that. Okay, and then we get this enigmatic reason for the reaffirmation in verse 5. This is probably one of the tougher verses here in this section. So what is going on? Look at what it says again, right? This is the reason why he's being blessed. He's blessed because Abraham, your father, obeyed me. He kept my charge. He kept my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So what's going on here? What is going on here? What's that?
He's keeping his promise to Abraham.
He is indeed. That's what God's doing. But think what it says. He's going to continue to pass it on because of what Abraham did. Abraham obeyed. We know that. He kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws.
I take from that, same thing happens to us. We get the benefit of what Christ did for us.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of picture that.
Mm-hmm.
He obeyed, we get the
benefit. Yeah, okay, I think you're close. He obeyed, we get the benefit. That's certainly, it's kind of imputation, right, if you think about it. That's a good one. I hadn't thought about it that way. We do see kind of a sense of imputation here. So his obedience is being imputed to his son, right, and then he's receiving the blessings of that. So that is a good point. I hadn't thought of that one.
I think the other part of that is what we're doing today can impact our children.
Mm-hmm.
What we're doing, our children can benefit, and that
right,
applies whether we disobey or whether we obey.
Right, and how we raise them and how we teach them and what we bring them up in. Yeah, I think it's another good implication or application of this section there. But I hadn't thought about the imputation, and I think you're right on that, Jim. The thing here that's challenging about this, though, is Abraham didn't have the law, did he? And this is the law. Didn't have the law, didn't have the commandments, he didn't have any statutes. But he did obey and he kept God's charge, right? So he did obey and he kept God's charge. So what's going on here, Abraham believed, he was declared righteous, and then what did he do? He demonstrated the obedience of faith. So it's kind of the idea that Jim was talking about. I think imputation would be kind of the theological kind of basis or thinking about that. But he had an obedience of faith, okay? So he was declared righteous, right? He didn't follow any laws. He didn't do anything perfectly, but he was declared righteous. And as a declared righteous man, he demonstrates an obedience arising out of his faith, okay? So faith intuitively obeys, doesn't it? Think about it, right? What's Paul's point as you get into Romans chapter 2? Talks about what? The Gentiles? What about the Gentiles? They obey. They have the law in their conscience. They intuitively do what is right. So I think the idea here is he's saying that Abraham intuitively, based upon his faith, did what was right, and I'm imputing that obedience to you. Okay, I'm going to have to add that. I'll footnote it and give you credit when I get down south, just like your son-in-law here. He got his one before. But he's imputing that to to Isaac in the process, right? So when you think about it, even though we don't have the law or you don't have the rules, you intuitively in our hearts know what's right. So Abraham intuitively demonstrated his faith and his agreement with what had been revealed to him at that point in time, primarily in his responsiveness to God's commands, right? Right? The things he told him. What did Abraham do? It says, God said do this. What's it normally say? He went quickly and did it. Right? He didn't think about it. He said, well, I'll get to that next week. You know, he basically went and did it. Okay? So we see that kind of obedience of faith, and I think that's what it's getting at here and how we should understand that. Now, Paul probably notes, or Paul ably notes this in Galatians 3:15 and following. Also, I think there's the idea here that law and promise, right, do not conflict with one another. Okay, so yes, it is promise that saved them, but law is not in conflict with the promise. You may remember that when Joe was going through Galatians. Probably seems like a long time ago now. Okay, so 6 to 11, and we'll wrap up with this. Let me read 6 to 11.
So Isaac settled in Gerar. When the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, she is my sister. For he feared to say, my wife, thinking lest the men of the place should kill me because of Rebekah, because she was attractive in appearance. When he had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah, his wife. Interesting translation.
No, that's actually a good translation.
Okay. So Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, she is your wife. How then could you say she is my sister? Isaac said to him, because I thought lest I die because of her. Abimelech said, what is this that you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. So Abimelech warned all the people, saying, whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death.
Okay, so you're reading an ESV, is that it? Yeah, that is, the laughing is actually a good translation, okay, because it's the same root verb as his name, okay. Well, Yitzhak. Yeah, so it's a funny wordplay in there. Okay, I'm just going to kind of introduce this because I'm going to have to rush too much. We'll get it next week. But so at the outset, it's interesting to note, really, that how quickly sin follows on the heels of blessing, right? He just got blessed. And what's the next thing we get? Sin, right? So can you think of a recent New Testament example that we've had that somebody just got a big blessing and sinned right on the heels of it?
Peter.
Good old Peter, right? The apostle with the foot-shaped mouth. Right? Sometimes he gets it right, sometimes he doesn't. Just got done declaring what? Jesus is the Christ, right? He answers the most important question, who is Jesus, right? And then right after that, right? Get behind me, Satan, right? So he goes in through the process. So Peter, Isaac calls a play from his father's playbook. We'll end with this question here. Though it's a Tishmor, technical term, Tish. It's a Tishmor egregious. So what's a little bit more egregious, or means bad, than what Abraham did?
She wasn't even his sister, not even in any way, shape, or form.
She was not a sister, okay? So Sarah was a half-sister. Rebecca was a cousin, okay? So he kind of took a little bit of license with that one, all right? In addition, I guess this is where we get kissing cousins from. Obviously, it didn't come from West Virginia. It came from the Bible all the way back then. Okay, so teasing aside, and because Isaac had seen how God had protected Abraham, right? So, you know, Isaac lived through all this. He saw his father go down. He saw his father play this move. And he saw God protect him every time. So I think it is a bit more egregious. He didn't learn too much from his father in that case. It was absolutely not his sister, but his cousin. And he had seen how God had protected his father. So he certainly didn't need to take that move. Reminding us that sin is just not logical, is it? I mean, sin doesn't make sense. We all have stuff that kind of bites us, right? And I can remember as an early Christian, as I was trying to get rid of stuff that I knew I shouldn't be doing in my life, when I did something good or something was going positive, I'd celebrate by something that was sinful. And I'm like, you idiot. You know, what are you thinking? But you see that they does it, right? Sin so easily follows on blessing because we think, hey, we're all good. Okay, we're all good. Now, Isaac's fears don't materialize, yet he persists in the deception. Why should he have changed course by now? Right? Why should he have changed course by now?
Besides the promise he just got?
Yeah, besides the promise, something in the text. Why should he have changed course? What's it say here in verse 8? Read the first part of the verse again. He'd been there a long time. Nothing had happened. Okay? So he probably should have changed course at this point in time. Let's wrap it there. We'll come back to it next week. Please try to be with us next week. It'll be a blessing both to the Hendrys and to you, I think, as well, to hear about their ministry in Brazil. And Dan, would you close us up in a word of prayer?
Father, we thank you for the pictures that we have here in the Old Testament, the lives of people who lived a long time. We see their struggles, we see their successes, their victories, and all as pictures of exactly how our lives are, except the difference is we have the Spirit of God living within us to prompt us. We have your revealed word as well. Thank you for that. Lord, teach us how to be faithful in our lives that we might be obedient to you. Bless us today as we learn about you.